Good evening. Welcome to the Solaria Report. This evening is Thursday, November 12, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Tonight we have money and markets, and then one question and ask Catherine, then our precious metals market report with Franklin Sanders. Let's go to the movies, Sir James Goldsmith's incredible interview in 1994 on GATT and the World Trade Organization, accurately predicting everything that's going on now. And so if you want to understand today's news, it's the best video I know to seeing the deeper trends and to seeing what's happening today, even though it was filmed in 1994. Our theme tonight is getting from falling income to rising incomes. What's been happening in America, it's also happening globally for most people who are not insiders, is our income and our employment and ownership is diminishing. And what we need to be talking about is what we can do to build income and employment and ownership, particularly equity. So with no further ado, money and markets. Last week, the official unemployment rate jumped over 10%. More announcements this week trying to persuade us that maybe it's not growing, but turning the other way. That's a very, very significant change. What we're watching is a real permanent change in the economy with significantly less employment as the U.S. deindustrializes and manufacturing continues to move abroad. And it's a real challenge for Washington, who right now is doing so many things that in fact encourage more unemployment. And one of those things relates to the equity markets. Another incredible story, Grant Thornton, who is an accounting firm and does a tremendous amount of government contracts, so very much a service company to insiders, published a report that was described and highlighted on the Zero Hedge blog, talking about the fact that one of the primary reasons for the rise in unemployment is the extent to which manipulation of the stock market and financial fraud techniques such as naked short selling are literally keeping healthy enterprises and long-term investors from finding each other. And it's a remarkable document from somebody that you would not expect it from. Remarkable in the sense that it describes in the equity component of the financial system the same thing we're seeing in the currency component. In other words, the casino financial system is literally stopping the real economy from doing what it wants to do and which is economic to do. And literally the real economy, whether it's the equity function of companies being able to raise equity capital, is literally destroying healthy enterprise and keeping, in other words, it's driving unemployment down. One thing that's not an answer to falling incomes is a greater dependency on the government, but that's what's happening. U.S. News and World Report had a report called The Government is Swallowing the Economy, or How the Government is Swallowing the Economy, and they report that economist Gary Schilling has calculated that 58% of the population is dependent on the government for a major part of their income. So that includes teachers, soldiers, bureaucrats, government employees, welfare, Social Security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Schilling predicts by 2018, 67% of Americans could be dependent on the government for their livelihood. Now, this is a frightening statistic because whether we're dependent on banks, debt from the banks, or dependent on government subsidies or employees, a free economy is not one who's dependent on large government for its jobs. So it's a very chilling report. So part of changing the income trend is doing it in a way where we get our incomes to go up, but not from dependency on the government. Healthcare bill passed the House. Interestingly enough, I just wanted to read you, I put this up on the blog, Denich Kucinich had sponsored an amendment that would allow individual states to create a single-payer system, a very important option there, because healthcare can be so different and preferences so different state to state, not just in healthcare, but in many different areas. you know, the option of a state doing its own thing is so relevant where there's interest on the ground to do that. And the Kucinich Amendment was stripped out of the House bill at the request of the Obama administration. But Kucinich voted against it when it passed, said as follows, quote, "The government is requiring at least 21 million Americans to buy private health insurance from the very industry that causes costs to be so high, which will result in at least $70 billion in new annual revenue, much of which is coming from taxpayers. This inevitably will lead to even more costs, more subsidies, and higher profits for insurance companies, a bailout under a Blue Cross." One of the things he mentions is that this is in essence a framework to cut Medicare. I live in Tennessee. One of my senators is Republican Lamar Alexander. I got an email from Alexander's office, I'm on his email list, saying remarkably many of the same things, including that this was a cut in Medicare. And so when you see Lamar Alexander and Dennis Kucinich saying the same thing, it's quite astonishing. Interestingly enough, Rasmussen surveys reported that after the House passed the health care, still the majority of voters still oppose the health care legislation. Two interesting things about the passage. There had been pressure on the House leadership to publish the bill 72 hours before a vote was called. That did not happen. And interestingly enough, this is a little aside, just after the bill passed, I got an irate call from a friend and subscriber who said, you know, I think the Fort Hood operation was designed to keep the health care legislation off out of the media. Now, who knows if that's true or not? That's just conjecture. But I find it funny when a farmer and subscriber starts thinking that way. And I've decided now I'm going to prepare for first quarter of 2010. I want to do a Let's Go to the Movies special on mind control. And I just want to give you a heads up now. The two movies we're going to have, at least two, that we're going to have you watch is Telephone with Charles Bronson and Manchurian Candidate with Denzel Washington. So if you're putting together a list of movies for the holidays, those are two to add. Another thing that went on the blog, up on the blog, that I thought was just an incredible job of reporting was a report from Amy Goodman at Democracy Now! On the General Motors carbon credits that were purchased in Brazil. And it describes a process whereby, in the name of improving the environment and lowering the footprint on the planet, the people with a large footprint are able to continue to have a large footprint as a result of their ability to basically depopulate people with a small footprint. And it's really quite extraordinary, and I simply leave it to you to watch it if you want a really good example of what cap and trade is all about. The political results of what's happening with unemployment, what's happening with the health care reform, was, according to a few Rasmussen surveys that are very interesting to just look down the list at. One, economy is once again listed as the top issues by voters. 45% now rate Obama's economic performance as poor. 58% say the next president is likely to be a Republican. We would say that getting a Republican president is not the long-term solution. In January, we're going to have a Solari report called "Who Is Your Sheriff?" And one of the things I keep trying to persuade everyone in our network is, for heaven's sakes, if you're going to invest time and money in campaigns and elections, you want to make sure who your local sheriff is, and you want to make sure who your local leadership is, because many of these issues are going to come down to federal jurisdiction versus local jurisdiction, and who you vote for in the national election will probably have significantly less impact than who you've got in position in your local positions. But the only one that has the power to back down the feds and keep them literally out of your county is your sheriff. So now is the time, 2010 is the time to pay attention to who's your sheriff, and we're going to talk more about that in January. Our hero this week, and we always, you know, I always get very upset, as you know, when somebody says, why is nobody doing anything? Because there are lots of people doing everything. And so our hero this week is Northwestern University professor David Protess and his journalist students at Northwestern University. Their class works to prove the innocence of people who've been wrongly prosecuted or it turns out are innocent after more research. They've been working on the case of a man for 3 years now who's convicted in 78 of killing a security guard, and they believe they have evidence that shows prosecutors put the wrong man behind bars. It turns out that their efforts have irritated Cook County prosecutors. Cook County is the Chicago county. They've irritated the Cook County prosecutors who have now subpoenaed the professor seeking the students' grades, his syllabus, and their private emails. The prosecutors are claiming that since the team was made up of students, that they may have been under pressure to prove a case just to get a good grade. And I think, you know, I have to tell you, this professor has finally found a way to get journalists, students to really understand investigative journalism in the United States. So our hat is off to him. Ask Catherine. Normally I don't have Ask Catherine when we have the pleasure of Franklin's company for the Precious Metals Market Report, but we have had a question at the CART, which is the second most popular question, which is, how do I tell the truth and stay alive? And I've been thinking of how I could do this. What, you know, do I have a special salary report just to talk through, you know, sort of my thoughts on how any of us can do that? Or do I just answer a few at the time? So I've decided to start and just comment, and I'm just going to go through them one at a time and then eventually wrap them up at the CART so you can have them all in one place. Two tonight I wanted to cover. First, it's very important if you're going to talk about what you think or what you feel, it's very important to recognize that we don't know the truth. I mean, I certainly don't know the truth. I think the important point to having a free and open media is we all have a piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And it is by sharing our different pieces and circulating our different pieces that we find other pieces. And when I first started to speak publicly in 1999, I was a very private person, would never talk about money or financial issues, you know, except in a limited circle. The thought of getting on a radio show and do it was absolutely shocking to me. And what I found out was that the more that I spoke publicly about what I had learned or what I knew, the more I came to realize that what I knew was a very, very tiny piece of the puzzle. And the more feedback I got and the more, you know, my piece started to connect with others who could put other pieces down on the table, it was a very humbling experience to get a much more broad-based perspective on what was happening. And so I've learned if you were to ask me all the different questions to cover the phenomena of reality in the galaxy, the reality is my answer to most questions is I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out. And I think if we can stay in the humility of knowing that we don't always know the truth, then our search for telling at least the truth that we see and we know is from a much greater place of humility, and will inspire a lot less offense. So number one is recognize that you don't necessarily know the truth. Number two is I've talked many times on the Salieri Reporter publicly about what I call the red button problem, and that is the fact that most people in the first world are dependent on the central banking warfare model and don't want the subsidy that's coming to them from that model to stop. So the specific reference to Red Button is when I asked a group of people at a conference on how we could help each other evolve spiritually, who would push the Red Button if they could stop all hard narcotics trafficking in their community, in their county, in their state, in their country tomorrow. The vast majority of them said they wouldn't stop it because they didn't want their mutual funds to go down, they didn't want their government checks to stop, and they didn't want their taxes to go up. So if you ask most audiences about whether or not they would be willing to stop our dependency on essentially the warfare machinery and organized crime, if it had the resultant impact on cash flows that it would, they won't support it. And so what I've come to understand that many people in the bureaucracy are literally keeping the red button from being pushed. They're as much prisoners of the model as we are. And so we have to be very critical about putting someone in a double bind. In other words, we can sit and criticize the central banking warfare model, but the vast majority of us are supporting it and financing it, and we don't want the red button to be hit. And so I have enormous sympathy for the fact that most of the people are prisoners of the model. And let me give you an example. When I went through my litigation, what I discovered was that the vast majority of people who were systematically trying to either frame or destroy me were as innocent as I was and were as being as manipulated as I was. So you had a few who were unbelievably courageous, and when the evidence showed that we were innocent, refused to do illegal or criminal things towards us and were run out of government or were harmed for their courage. We had other people who were not prepared to stand up to the same extent, but were very ashamed by what was happening. And it was their shame that would cause audit teams to have to be replaced or the impact of what was happening to slow down. And it made a tremendous, it was a tremendous advantage for us that they had a conscience. We, you know, there were some who were dirty, but my assessment, and I'm only guessing, I can only conjecture from what I saw, was that they were threatened in meaningful ways. So they had real legal or physical violence threat. We had one judge who died of fast-acting cancer. There were others who I think were manipulated with a variety of sort of subtle or not so subtle, sort of under the counter benefits. Now some were really evil. They were, you know, they were either jealous of us or they just enjoyed hurting, or you know, it was like sport. It was hunting. But what you saw in the whole process was that who was a good guy and who was a bad guy was much more muddled. And that ultimately, if you looked at the economics of what they were doing, they were stopping us from doing something that would have pushed the red button. If in the mid-90s, if our software tools had been allowed to roll out and if the work we were doing for the Department of Housing and Urban Development had been allowed to continue, then the housing bubble couldn't have happened, the mortgage fraud couldn't have happened, and in fact, you could have even crashed the global financial system. And so what we were doing was inadvertently pushing the red button, and the reality was the vast majority of Americans didn't want the red button pushed, and so whatever they were doing to stop us and to get the honest people out of Washington reflected the majority consensus of American people. And so who's the bad guy becomes much, much more muddled in that situation. So just remember that everyone is one way, shape, form, or another a prisoner of the model. And the question for all of us is, how can we individually take responsibility to change the model, but in a way which is good for us? Because the number one problem we're all struggling with is our time, our energy is being drained, and things are happening in terms of political control and economic control, which are dangerous to us or to our children and grandchildren. So part of it is simply taking responsibility for our own complicity in the red button problem. So anyway, that's my first two comments on how to tell the truth and stay alive. Recognize you don't necessarily know the truth, and recognize your own and all of our complicity in keeping the central banking warfare model and our dependency on its success. So with that, let's go to our precious metals market report. I can report to you with pleasure. I had the pleasure of coming over to the top of the world farm yesterday, so I'm on quite a high because I've been on the top of the world for the last day and a half, and just had dinner with Franklin and his family. And so, Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Okay, well, I must say I've had a wonderful time, so now it's time to share you with everyone else.
has been fun for us.
So tell us, you know, what's been happening is so amazing in the precious metals market for the last month since you've been on the Celerity Report. So catch us up over what's happened over the last month and the current action in the market.
Well, the gold has continued to advance, and it went through, of course, 1018, burst through that, ran up to 1065, ran in place, and then jumped up again this week on through the 1065 area and went up to 1100, jumped to 1117, 1120 yesterday, and then came back. So you've had this process going on that's jump, run in place, jump, run in place. And the question is whether or not it's time for a larger correction. I don't know. I'm frankly, you know, curious myself. That gold, if you look at the momentum indicators, gold probably peaked a week ago. The momentum did, and, you know, it came back down. So it doesn't look as overbought now as it looked a week ago, but usually those momentum indicators go down farther. I looked at the gold-silver ratio. The high came exactly when we expected it. Well, one day off when we expected it. I expected the low in the market, the high in the gold-silver ratio, which is they're always the opposite, to come on the 30th. The lows in the market actually came on the 28th, which not coincidentally was options expiration date, so that all the nice people who sell options didn't have to pay up on that big, huge bunch of 1050 options that they had, sold. And so now we're, you know, the question is, well, is it going to go farther from here? Or are we going to have another correction? I think if we have another correction, probably it will stop at 1065. Again, that's the level it broke out of, and if it goes back to that, if it goes back, it'll test that area and then decide whether it's going to go forward or not. I have to say that my bias, based on, especially on thinking about the gold-silver ratio, is that we're going to get a low in that ratio, which is a top in gold and silver, somewhere between the 28th of December and the 11th of February. And that ratio will go down to about 52-1 at that time. And that will be time for us to swap out of gold and out of silver and into gold. But the real fly in the ointment has been silver. You know, the market proverb is that bull markets climb a wall of worry. And what that means is that there's always somebody around who can give you 18 good reasons, valid reasons, why the market cannot go any higher. And those people are around now. It's always that way. You always worry while the market advances. Is this it? Is this the end of it? Is this the limit of it? So you're seeing that wall of worry right now, and silver is the primary contributor to that, because silver, having gone down much more in fall of 2008 than gold did, had farther to come. And it's certainly gained more ground back than gold has, although it has not gone to new all-time highs. And it's gotten to $18, well, $17.60, and it's stalled. And today it fell back to the bottom of its trading range, which is $17.20 to $17.60. And it fell down to the bottom of that range at $17.25. So you want gold and silver to move together. They ought to, you know, they're a family. They ought to speak with one voice. And when they're arguing, when one of them's going one way and one's going the other, then there's some kind of disagreement. There's a problem. And so right now, after the gold took a slap in the face today, we're just going to have to wait and see. The bigger question, looking back longer, is this. And I think I want to stress before I say this, I think this is the least likely outcome. But it is a possible outcome, and that is that the correction that we saw that went to 705 in fall of 2008 may not have been the bottom of the correction, because corrections usually take place in three waves. That is, they go down in three waves. They go down to the bottom of an A wave, they go up to the top of a B wave, and then they go down again to the bottom of a C wave before they begin to advance again. So it's not clear to me, and I don't think it would be clear to anybody looking, that the that what we saw last fall has been completed. It probably has. One of the reasons I say that is because when gold went above $1,000, it didn't go 2% above $1,000. It did not go 3% above $1,000, which are marginal, which would be marginally exceeding the previous line of resistance or support. It went 10% beyond. You know, it went from 10,000 to 11,000. From 1,000 to 1,100. And so that's a 10% increase over the previous high. Now, B waves, those, you know, that's the, if you go down A and you come back up B and then go down C, that B wave is notoriously optimistic. And it seems so strong, it can often seem so strong that it seems like another advance. It can even go to a new high, and then the market can collapse down to a lower low than the bottom of the A wave. That is a possibility. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I think it's the least likely possibility, for the reason that, again, gold exceeded the old high not by 2 or 3%, but by 10%, more than 10%, in fact. So the bias is still, our expectation still has to be gold is going to go higher. What would happen if it did collapse again in a C wave? Well, it'd probably go down to 665. You know, that's the obvious line of support in the on the chart. I don't think
2 months ago you said 650, so we're 15 up.
Well, okay, yeah, so we're gaining all the time.
We're gaining all the time.
But you're going to know, because here's the way you're going to know that the real line in the sand is $1,018. That was the high close for gold before it broke out. And so if it goes below, closes below that whole area, you know, 1018, 1025, then you'd have to say, well, we're going to get a bigger deal here. We're going to get a bigger correction. The point I'd like to really make, though, is even if it goes down to 665, even if that happened, which is the maximum I would expect, you're still in a bull market. You're still in a bull market, and the upward trend is going to bail out any timing mistakes that you make. So I think you just have to look at it now. If you get a substantial correction now down to 1065, I'd buy some more. If it went down to 1025, I'd buy some more. I'd be nervous, but I'd buy some more, and then I'd wait and see what happened. And if it went through 1025, then I'd hold off for a long time. I'd hold off until the situation clarified.
Right. Well, I'll never forget when gold hit the high. I think it was 2000. Was it 2006? It hit 714.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine called me and said, we have to sell. And I said, well, if we sell, where are we going to go? And there was a long silence for about 10 seconds, and they said, oh, right. Forget it.
Yeah, exactly.
It was like when I lived in New York, when my husband used to come home and co-ops were skyrocketing in price, he'd say, you know, we could get X for our co-op, let's sell. And I said, where are we going to live? Okay, well, I guess the big question is the one we've been asking for the last 2 months, which is, you know, will the $1,000 floor hold? Are we standing firmly on a $1,000 floor? And clearly things are looking better, but it's still not, you know, the vote's not in yet.
Well, and you can never know except in hindsight.
Right.
But one of the things that people forget is we invest with the primary trend.
Right.
The trend is your friend means that trend is going to go for 15 or 20 years. It's going to carry everything up with it. It's a rising tide. You align yourself with it, and when you've got a market that's in a primary uptrend, then the resolution of things is always going to be upward.
Right, in your favor.
Right, in your favor. And so that's one of the reasons why I don't – it's a very unwise idea for almost every investor to try to pick peaks sell and with the intention of buying back later when the market.
Right. Drops. I think the hard thing for people is if I'm planning on accumulating, do I buy now? Do I average in? Do I go later? Because if you watch the folks who bought at 1,000 in 2008 and then watched it drop, you know, almost 300 points. You don't want that to happen to you. So I think that because the volatility is so extraordinary, it's people who are really accumulating now trying to figure, do I go now, do I average, or do I go later?
Well, you know, this is probably not a very good analogy, but it's sort of like if you were trying to build a good marriage and, you know, things were going great and everything was on the upswing and then things hit the rocks and you started disagreeing and you said, well, I think I'm going to get a new wife and start all over. and if you did that every 2 or 3 years, you know, you're not going to build a good marriage because you've got to stay with one person and work on that same thing and that same task. And it's a lot the same way with an investment. You're in a sense married to an investment for a primary trend. Now, there comes a time, and here's where my analogy breaks down, there comes a time where you no longer are riding that trend because the trend changes. And you have to admit that, you have to change, and you've been friends a long time, but it's time to part ways with whatever the investment was.
Right. And to me, you have to look at the geopolitics on this. This is not internet stocks are up kind of thing. We're looking at a global demand by 2+ billion people and a variety of different institutions for a currency that will protect their purchasing power.
Right. Well, you know, it's a revolutionary change. It's a sea change, if you will, that's taking place in the monetary world. And what you're seeing is this is what's driving the market. The switch of monetary demand from national fiat currencies, the yen, the pound, the dollar, the euro, to gold, because those currencies cannot perform. They are losing market share to the alternative, to the market leaders, which are silver and gold.
Right, and it's important to understand that they're very tiny, thin markets.
Oh, goodness gracious, yes. Yeah.
So we're talking about all the money on the planet having to pile into, you know, something like threading a needle here.
Right, exactly.
So let's talk about the carry trade, because one of the mysteries in all of this is we clearly have an extraordinary carry trade. And let me just explain for everyone what I mean by carry trade. We're watching the Federal Reserve lend to the primary dealers for a half of 1%. So imagine if your home equity line of credit or your mortgage or your credit card, you could borrow at a half of 1%. And they can use to collateralize that loan their stock market position. And there's nothing to then stop them from leveraging that position with all sorts of debt and derivatives. So essentially, you're watching the federal credit being used to finance the stock market. And as not surprisingly, we're watching sort of a new bubble in the equity markets. And the question, of course, is to what extent is that extraordinary liquidity spilling over into the precious metals markets and the gold price? And so let me put that question to you, Franklin. What do you think?
Well, let me describe first the mechanism of this dollar carry trade. There are two reasons that someone would buy dollars and invest the proceeds into something else, or borrow dollars, if you will. One is the interest rate is so extraordinarily low. And number two, they expect to pay back with cheaper dollars than they borrowed.
Right.
So it's like free money. You know, it's like the Fed is saying, back up the truck, here's free money. Load up and go wherever you want with it. The problem with that is that when they borrow dollars, they're short dollars. That means they've got to pay back dollars in the future. And so everything goes great as long as the dollar interest rate stays low, but especially as long as the dollar keeps dropping. When the dollar begins to rise, then they're caught in the worst of all possible worlds because the markets they've invested in are going to be dropping, and the dollar that they owe, the stocks that they bought or the commodities that they bought are going down and the dollar is going up. So things are going exactly the opposite to what they thought. And that creates panics and it creates short squeezes where those people who are short dollars rush to get into dollars. And there's no question that has been financing the equity market, and I think probably the Fed knew that it would finance the equity market anyway. They intended that. But how much of that has gone into gold and silver? You have to believe that all of the rise in gold and silver in the last 18 months has been due to that dollar carry trade, to believe that once the carry trade blows up, that gold and silver will collapse. And that's not the case. That's a fundamental misapprehension of the primary forces that are driving the gold market. The primary force driving the gold market is this revolutionary shift in monetary demand away from fiat currencies, which are failing, to gold and silver, which are not failing. And so even though the dollar carry trade may have stoked gold demand by adding some marginal or incremental amount of demand, it's not the major force.
Well, interestingly enough, historically, if you look at the list, and it's up on the blog, if you do a search for primary dealers, you get a list of the, several months ago I posted the official list of primary dealers, most of which are not U.S. firms, the majority of which are not U.S. firms. What you'll see on that list is a group of firms that traditionally have used, my hypothesis, government resources and financial resources from the Fed and Treasury to suppress the gold price. So you kind of wonder, you know, if the Fed isn't financing half of them to push it down and providing liquidity to all of them, it's also pushing it up. So, you know, the war is getting quite intimate.
Well, then that would be, that would be the perfect thing to do, to spoil the public's taste for gold, to let it run way up and then
push it down,
push it way down, and then of course all of the beaten investors go scurrying off to their caves saying, well, I'll never do that again. And if you look at the way that the government has operated, and I have to confess here, I am a subscriber to the conspiracy theories. I am a subscriber to the idea.
No, I just have to interrupt you because I spent a lifetime in Washington and Wall Street, and I thought conspiracies was basically our model of how things got done. So the fact that anybody would think that, I mean, to me, that's how you organize business and government is, and they're not necessarily illegal. So I would like to defend conspiracies because, in fact, that's how it works.
Well, here's the thing. I've got the goods on them because in 1934 they passed the I think it's called the Gold Reserve Act, and in it they created the Exchange Stabilization Fund. Now,
mother of all slush funds.
Right. And what is the? It's a secret slush fund.
Right.
That is specifically created to manipulate the price of the dollar and the price of gold. That's what its purpose is.
Let me just step back for the subscribers. The Exchange Stabilization Fund is a fund of the Treasury Department, which is managed by the New York Fed as agent for the U.S. Treasury, reporting directly to the Secretary of Treasury. So no member, no governmental worker or member of the bureaucracy of Treasury is involved.
Well,
it's just the private New York bank. And there's a great, Franklin, I don't know if I've ever described this to you, in Blowback, a wonderful book by a professor at the American University, it describes the Dulleses sitting at Sullivan and Cromwell and using the money that had been laundered back. They seized the Nazi money that had been stolen from the Jews during World War II, and rather than give it back to the victims, they laundered it into the Exchange Stabilization Fund and then used it to rig the European elections and the Italian elections in 1948 for the Vatican, at the request of the Vatican. It's described all of this. And so, you know, one of my theories of U.S. history is a lot of covert operations is just people trying to find a way to replenish the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
Well, you know, and the important thing about the Exchange Stabilization Fund is this is the opposite of transparency.
Right.
I mean, it's surrounded with concrete bricks.
Right.
They don't report to anybody. They don't explain to anybody.
And they're free to intervene in the markets in whatever way they want.
That's exactly right. So they manipulate the gold market. Well, just put yourself in their position. If you were manipulating the gold market, wouldn't you want to try to burn the maximum number of people possible? Your job is not just simply to keep the price down. You're trying to
trying to make it as volatile as possible.
Right. You're trying to
make money doing it.
Right. Just cap rises and keep cap and rises until finally time comes that there naturally will occur a decline, and then when the decline occurs, you sell into it, you accelerate the decline, you scare more people, and you burn more people, and therefore they'll stay out, and it'll take longer for the market to recover. So that would be a typical operation if they did something like that, and all they're doing really is just increasing the speed of the market at the margin. But it doesn't, the main thing to remember.
Doesn't change the long-term trend.
That's exactly right. It doesn't change the long-term trend.
Doesn't change the long-term trend. Very quickly, we have a couple of great questions that I want to go to quickly. Devaluation question, how does fiat currency devaluation work? And sort of my theory on how to describe this is it can go slow, it can go medium, or it can go fast. And slow is what we've been experiencing in the U.S. with the slow burn.
Since 1913.
Right. So basically, the insiders tax the outsiders with a slow inflation. And I guess since 1913, the U.S. dollar has dropped in purchasing power by about 96%, right?
From $20.67 to the ounce to $1,100
right.
to the ounce.
So it's a pretty significant inflation, especially when the majority of us have our money in dollars. Medium, I would describe as sort of what happened in Latin America. You wake up, your money's in the bank, you can only take out a little bit at a time, but meantime the currency's dropping. And so your money gets inflated away faster. And I would say fast is what happened in Russia or Eastern Europe, which is, you know, you have pension plans and you have lots of money in the bank, but you wake up and it's worth zero. Because the ruble has literally gone to zero.
Right.
And so you're wiped out. A variation on that is what's called a radical devaluation, which is engineered at a governmental level. Presumably this would be through G20 and the central banks. You go to bed, gold's at 1,100, you wake up, it's 3,500 overnight.
This is the either Friday or Sunday surprise.
Right.
I'm serious. The timing is impeccable. I remember when I was going to school in Germany, Susan was working at the American Express in Berlin as a cashier. And one Friday we went home, the exchange rate was 4.25 marks to the dollar. And when we came back on Monday, it was like 360, literally. And
right.
I mean, that was at that time. Of course, to us today, you know, that doesn't sound like so much, but it was a huge revaluation. It was, you know, just not quite a collapse, but it was huge. And it happened. They announced it, as I remember, it was Friday after the markets had closed in the United States. So no one can protect themselves against what's happened.
Right. And the reality is we're not describing an economic phenomenon. We're describing a political phenomenon.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Right. The pressure builds. And finally, to take the pressure off, there's an official devaluation. And that's happened in a lot of places. That's happened in Great Britain. It's happened all over the world.
But we've been so protected from it. And if you haven't lived through it or talked to people who have, it's very hard to kind of fathom it intimately for yourself.
Well, I think, I'll be honest, as much as I despise the Federal Reserve and the whole paper money system, at least there were responsible people managing it until probably, you know, Greenspan came on.
Right.
When I say responsible people, what I mean is they at least had enough humility to understand they were dealing with cosmic forces of the universe. That is, of our universe, because the dollar was the monetary mainstay of the rest of the world. And they understood, look, we can't mess around with this. We've got to keep – we may be inflating away the value 2-4% a year, but we don't want any big waves here.
We want to be invisible. We don't want to be superheroes on the cover of Time magazine.
Right. We just want to be technocrats doing our job, and we want to make sure that when we retire that things are about as stable as they were when we left. The dollar may have depreciated by 30% over 10, 15 years, but that's okay. The main thing is that we kept things in order. Now you get people like Greenspan and Bernanke, and they do the wildest imaginable things, and I think the reason is their arrogance. I think these people think that they're masters of the universe. I can do, by golly, I got the power, and I can do any dad burn thing I want to do. So don't tell me.
They've created with satellites and a whole bunch of technological developments in GATT. They've created a taxation system that will tax globally, and that gives them the ability to be remarkably arrogant and to get away with it for some period of time. Well, let's quick go on. Another quick question. What are the pros and cons of holding gold in other countries versus in our own possession?
Well, I suppose it's a good idea if you've got enough money, you know, if you've got a lot of money that you can send overseas and you're not going to hurt for it. But I think the primary place that you have to hold gold or silver is in your own possession. You have to physically own it in your own possession. And the reason for that is really very simple. Gold and silver are cash. They're the ultimate cash. And, you know, if you had just imagine it this way. Say that you have a $3,000 stash of, you know, $10 bills that you keep in your house just in case something goes wrong and you've got to have it. Well, you don't want to have to go to the bank and draw that out when your emergency happens on Saturday.
Right.
You can't get it. And possession is the most important part of having that hedge, that stash, if you will, that hidey-hole with gold and silver. And so you want the physical possession first. If you're going to hold it overseas, you know, we've had a lot of discussions about this, and I really still think that James Turk's gold money is the best way to do that, because really what you're trying to do is you're trying to hold purchasing power where it won't.
Well, there's something else. I trust the Swiss a lot more than I trust Americans.
Oh, my goodness.
Including some of my neighbors. So I'm not always there to watch over it. You know, I travel. So, you know, I'm a squirrel, as you know. So I like a little pot here and a little pot there. I just don't like everything in one place. And so to me, it's a balance. The first most important is to have it in your own possession. But then, you know, there are jurisdictions which are more lawful than ours. So I think it's a balance. And I don't think any one of them is perfect. There are scenarios where one is more advantageous than the other, but there are other scenarios when it's vice versa, so there's no way to know. Quick question. Does Solari find the Texas ratio a realistic guide to bank solvency? I think the Texas ratio is useful. I don't like depending on financial ratios, particularly because I think the governance and the management of a banking institution is the most important thing I look at. And then the second most important thing I look at is, does it have deep roots and loyalty in a community? So is it, you know, does it have the possibility of an income even in bad or worse cases? So what's the sort of earnings power in that place in the intermediate term? And then you go to the financial statement. One of the reasons I don't like depending on a ratio and not digging down into the financial statements, if I or someone I care about is going to be, if I'm looking at it for them, and that is, you know, I don't trust financial statements, and I don't necessarily trust accounting systems, so I don't like to depend on them, and so I like to say who's governing, who's managing, and, you know, who is doing business with them, and is that business something that's got a future? And then finally, Franklin, for you, should we take the new Kitco Gold Index seriously?
I'm not really impressed by that. I think that it's important, at least for me weekly, to look at the price of gold in other currencies. But the main thing that's important is the primary trend of gold against most currencies up. And I don't really see, I mean, it just seems kind of superfluous to me, the Kitco Index.
So the Kitco Index is a little bit like the U.S. dollar index. It measures the gold performance in a basket of currencies as opposed to just the dollar. So if we're looking at spot price in dollar, it's just straight dollar, and the Kitco index is looking at it in five currencies. And I guess I think it's five. The hard part for me is I think, there's no arbitrage left, really, between the different currencies and gold. And so I just think it's more complicated and it's really not necessary. But to me, all information is useful. So,
well, it's a little bit like somebody who thinks that he's going to protect himself against dollar depreciation by going into euros.
Right.
I just shake my head and say, you know, do you understand that the euro is in worse shape and has a worse structure than the dollar does?
Well, but if we're looking at bonds, I would say there are a lot of bonds in euros that I think have more fundamental economics behind them in a worse case than the treasuries. So I might, you know, on the bond side and credits, I would vote for Europe or many European countries before I would vote for treasury.
Right, but as far as the currency is concerned, the euro is about like the dollar and has even more political problems. So, but I think right now there's no question they're managing the euro more conservatively than they are the dollar. But if I'm faced with the euro, the dollar, the yen, or gold, there's no choice.
Right. All fiat currencies are inflating significantly.
Right.
So the amazing thing that happened at Saleri this week was that the one question shot to the top of the charts, Franklin. I was astonished. And if any leading indicator tells me that there's a real hunger for a new global currency, it's the fact that this question, as of Tuesday, had 30 votes, which is, how do I start a local precious metals currency?
Mm-hmm.
So you have 5 minutes to teach us how to do that.
Ouch. Okay, I've got 5 minutes to teach you what I've spent 29 years learning. Okay.
Well, yeah, but that's why you've been working hard in the trenches so that we can have it in 5 minutes.
Well, you and I talked earlier, and I think I would really like for you to post to your blog the article that I published in the Money Changer last month about how to do this. And that was aimed primarily for people who are interested in starting a local currency to have an exchange for silver. And the central thing to remember is you want to start with, you know, a certain amount of inventory. You could start with a bag, you know, depending on how big your community is and how fast it grows, you'll need more inventory. And whoever operates the exchange needs to have a public place, and it needs to be open, you know, roughly 9 to 5 so that it's convenient for people to.
I always thought the way to do it was to put it in the food stores, in a grocery or a farmer's market.
Yeah, in the customer service part of a store, yeah.
Perfect.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
It'd be a perfect place. And with the gold and silver exchange calculator that we have on silver and gold or money that you and I have created and put up on the Internet, they've got a constant exchange. They've got a constant gold price and silver price so that you always know what the price ought to be. And the way an exchange operates is that you buy at one price and you sell at another, the sales price or the ask price being just a little bit higher. And I think probably that you can do it on a 3% spread between buy and sell.
Now, here's the challenge. In states where there's some states that don't tax precious metals,
mm-hmm.
but there are other states that do. And so where you're selling a coin or you're an exchange, and that's deemed to be a sale of tangible properties. In Tennessee, we have a 9% plus sales tax.
Let me tell you why that doesn't apply.
Okay.
It's a complete monetary exchange. You're exchanging one form of legal tender for another form of legal tender. And if you're worried about that, what you do is you get each customer to sign a statement that says, I'm exchanging money for money. That's what I want to do. That's what I intend to do. So nobody can come behind you and say otherwise. And the problem that the government has in trying to collect a sales tax is, which exactly is happening? If I take my dollars, if I take $13 and I exchange that for $1 in silver, haven't I lost $12?
I've lost $12,
right? I mean, there's a loss there as far as the law is concerned, not as far as the market is concerned, but as far as the law is concerned. So if they're going to try to make me say that there's a gain when I sell $1 of silver and get $12.50 in paper for it, if that's a gain, then the other one's a loss.
Right, but I'll tell you one thing before, because you know it's my intention to try and see this happen where I live. Before that happens, I'm going to have my lawyers go through all the state tax issues backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
And what would happen if I exchange it for broccoli? You know, so I want to know what happens if I exchange it for money, and what happens if I exchange it for broccoli.
Right.
Or, yeah, I guess where I am for pecans.
Well, you know, part of this is the kind of person who's going to undertake this is pretty much a pathbreaker to begin with.
Right.
So he's not going to be stopped. I don't think that that's a problem, because it's the United States, it's controlling federal law that defines both 90% silver coin and the paper Federal Reserve notes as money. They're the ones that have created the system. I didn't create the system.
Right.
And they're the ones who, through their depreciation, have depreciated the paper dollar against the dollar of silver. So I didn't create the system, but they made the system, and it says that a dollar of silver is equal to a dollar of paper or a dollar of gold.
Well, I think the way to start, you know, step one to getting a local precious metals currency is getting people educated and buying just for their own account coins and getting comfortable with them, because it takes a period of time. And one of the reasons that Solera wanted to do the calculator is every Christmas I give the kids in my family, I give them gold and silver coins.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the coins, you know, that I get through the map.
Mm-hmm.
And I need the calculator because I'm trying to make sure I give the same, you know, the same value to each kid. And anyway, so part of it is just getting, if you can start to build a critical mass of people in your place, you know, get them educated about precious metals, get them buying and learning about precious metals, you know, you need that critical mass before you can start to the next step. And the beauty of a precious metals currency to me is, if you've ever tried to start a sort of a local fiat currency,
mm-hmm.
it's very complicated and time-consuming. It requires a lot of consensus and paperwork. And the beauty of precious metals, particularly if you have the, you know, if you just use the calculator, is you just do it.
Well, not only that, but everybody wants it. Because one of the problems with these local fiat currencies like the Ithaca hours and things like that is nobody wants to take them. You know,
right.
they may want to use them, but they don't want to take them. And it's the exact opposite with silver and gold. They want to take them, then they
it's in a rising trend.
Right. They don't want to spend them. So I think that probably the key to this, you know, I've got Patricia Wheat over in South Carolina.
Right.
A little bitty town, Belly in South Carolina, that's got 533 people. And she's just organized everybody into this committee and that committee, but they've got the merchants on board to do this.
That's the thing. You need a critical mass of people and merchants.
Right. And once you've got that critical mass, then people go in the first time and they'll say, hey, I want to pay for this in silver. Can I do that? And the merchant says, well, yeah, sure. I'd rather have you pay that way. And so maybe he makes them a little bit better price if they pay in the form of silver. And they go home feeling like they got the greatest bargain in the world, and they've really, you know, they've done something new. And very quickly that's gonna spread. But
what I ought to do is write an article for the local paper
mm-hmm.
on how much money is the float in our retail transactions.
Mm-hmm.
And if we'd had that float in silver instead of dollars, how much richer we'd all be.
Right, because the banks wouldn't have been stealing from us.
Anyway, well, you know, there are some good local banks. They're at the mercy of this as much as we are, so it's not all the banks. Okay, so let's jump to our movie, because I've encouraged the subscribers to watch Sir James Goldsmith, very successful businessman, built Hansen and numerous other companies, and literally took time from his business career in the early 90s to try and warn people about the changes underway with the Uruguay Round of GATT and the creation of the World Trade Organization, which he described very eloquently as the establishment against the rest of society. And in the process of trying to stop the Uruguay Round of GATT from being adopted in Europe, he came to the United States, and in 1994, November, did an interview with Charlie Rose of Bloomberg. And it is prescient. It is one of the best descriptions of what is happening now that I've ever seen. And the beauty of his description of all of this in 1994, he's predicting everything that's going on now, is it's so clear that it was planned and that it was intentional. He understood clearly what was going to happen and what was being rolled out. at the highest levels and was able to describe it very succinctly and clearly. And let me just walk through a couple of the things he described. One is the global industrialization of agriculture and the massive destabilization of society as a result of that. Another, he describes the free movement, or I would say the unhindered corporate movement of capital employment, which is a very fundamental shift in the relationship between labor and capital. Now, what he doesn't describe but is also happening at the same time is enormous suppression of technology and the use of violence and regulation and coercion to ensure centralized control of capital as well. And so all the things that would benefit the labor equation are suppressed or controlled, and those things that would benefit corporations are allowed to move freely. He describes a very fundamental economic issue, which we've talked about many times, and that is shifting profits to corporations on the theory that you're making a particular product more efficient when you externalize the costs of this process to people, communities, and governments, which can be financed with the creation of poverty, with taxes, and with inflation. Probably, I would say, the biggest form of financing has been this slow-burn inflation. And so what is efficient for the product pricing and corporate profits is uneconomic for the total system. And so you get this effect of centralizing wealth while you shrink total wealth in society. And he points out that the economy should be subservient to society, and it's kind of my, I think most of the subscribers know my index, the Solari index or Popsicle index, which is sort of a rule of thumb of how healthy the living in human capitalism, the place that the index is the percent of people within a community who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a Popsicle, and come home alone safe. I have to say, Franklin, because the grandchildren are always around the money changer trading floor, and so the Popsicle index at the money changer is highest of any business I've ever seen. But he talks a lot about the alignment of financial interests with human interests and how that's important for total wealth. He doesn't use that word, but it's essentially the same idea. And what is incredible, talk about prescient, he warns that the financial system will pose real problems for the real economy. And that's exactly what we're talking about today, which is if the currency is part of a casino and the stock market is part of a casino, it's stopping healthy investors from meeting healthy enterprises, and it's stopping people who want to do real business and trade from being able to do it because of the volatility and the depreciation. He warns about derivatives, and so it's a brilliant understanding of what's coming and how damaging it's going to be. It is astonishing when you realize, as he talks, the extent to which what he calls, and rightly so, the most important economic decision of our lifetimes has been made with no discussion, no media, no public process, literally an invisible thing. And it proves also, you know, back to my outrage at saying, why is it nobody's doing anything? The power and the courage of one man doing what he did is extraordinary and very inspiring. I mean, very inspiring. And finally, it really does prove we knew that we were going to do something that was devastating to billions of people globally. And so, you know, really an extraordinary thing. And I just would, before we finish talking about it, Franklin, I just ask you if, because you've now watched it twice and we watched it last night together, any thoughts on this amazing, amazing, prescient description?
Well, one of the things, and you touched on it, but one of the things that he said that really brought together an enormous movement in the 20th century was the industrialization of agriculture. I think the number he used was 3.15 billion or 3.5 billion people live in rural areas, and mechanizing agriculture just in the next 10 or 15 years would throw a billion of those people off the land. And what that means is that where there were no slums before, you create slums. And he makes that wonderful point, Catherine, that in Brazil there were no favelas, the slums, before
the Green Revolution.
Before the Green Revolution, the industrialization of agriculture.
Right.
And You know, I know that we have this idea, people want to move off the land and they want to go into the city where they can have a good life and they don't have to work so hard. That's really a shallow understanding. I mean, when somebody lives on the land that he's lived on for several generations, he has a place and station in the world. He has a use and a value. And when you replace him with, tractors, combines, and so forth, and I'm not a Luddite, you understand that.
Right.
But nonetheless, when you just push all these people suddenly off the land, they don't have any way to make a living.
Right. It's what he doesn't use the word depopulation. But when he talks about how devastating this is going to be for 2 billion plus people, if you read between the lines, he's referring to something which will bring about enormous depopulation.
Right. What they've done is they have rendered by their economic policies, and they're not inevitable economic policies. This is not just, this is the march of progress. We all have to get out of the way.
It's less economic.
Right. It's actually less economic because fewer people make money out of it than before. They make much more money, but there are many fewer people, and other people are cut completely out of a way to make a living.
Right. So the thing shrinks.
Right. Exactly. It's
right.
It's the same process the fellow that wrote Cannibal's All back in the middle of the last century talked about that when the serfs were freed in the Middle Ages, George Fitzhugh is his name. What happened was they went from a position where they had security in childhood, in old age, in infirmity, because the Lord owed them a living, whether they could work or not, to a position where they had no social welfare structure at all, and they were very much the junior partners in the labor capital exchange, and so wages are bid down to so low that they're barely starvation wages. And that's the mechanism that is turned loose when you throw all of these people off the land.
Right.
It's the same mechanism. And you create huge slums, and we've created those slums in this country that way.
Right. And so I want to say it again, to understand this week's news, to understand what's going to happen over the next year or two, I don't know of one better video. It's up on the blog. It's up on YouTube. You can just watch it off of your computer. Sir James Goldsmith with Charlie Rose in 1994, predicting what's happening now and the long-term trends that we're grappling with. And we've reached a point now where the frustration to the real economy of the casino financial system is such that it is becoming an opportunity to find new ways of circulating equity, to find new ways of operating with new kinds of currencies. And so that is our opportunity, and it's an opportunity that we need to be talking about if we're going to build income and ownership and employment and equity. So with that, Franklin, thank you so much. We're going to put your Silver Exchange article up on the blog. It will be up on the blog by Monday. And I really encourage folks to get it, to print it out, circulate it around, get people talking about it. I know I kept saying to Franklin, we need to do these in towns where we have a really great sheriff and town council behind us. So I want to stress again, in January, we'll talk with Richard Mack about who's your sheriff, but start nosing around and figuring out who your sheriff is and what the sheriff election is in 2010, because if you're going to start a gold and silver exchange, you need the right sheriff. Okay, so coming up next on November 20th, we have a great interview with James E. Hughes, one of the premier lawyers in the country, on family wealth. Wonderful book he wrote. It's interviewed in the blog. I reviewed it in the blog. You can do a search. James E. Hughes, November 20th. And on December 4th, I've spent a year reading and looking for the right person to talk about identity theft. We have Terry Collin, Protecting Yourself from Identity Theft. She was the author of the Wall Street Journal book on identity theft in 2005. She reminds me that a lot has happened since 2005. So she's going to be with us on December 4th. To talk about something that I think all of us want to avoid if we can. She was inspired to write the book because she got hit by identity theft. So we're talking about somebody who's been there and lived through it. So until next week, Just remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.